positive change and a positive atmosphere in the world. But more important than that is the Islamic revolution that occurred in Iran because of various obvious reasons. You see, in Iran, we didn't have imperial rule. There was no country that ruled over Iran in a colonial manner. They used their pawns and their stooges to rule, but at the end of the day, it was apparently an independent country. So you cannot say that the social condition of colonial rule was the reason behind a revolution in Iran. You cannot say that. For the other communities, you can say it. For example, in Africa or in Asia, there were communities under the yoke of imperialism, and they fought that imperialism. And people could argue that maybe because they wanted to be free, they came and fought, and they performed that revolution. But in Iran, it was something beyond that. There were some other reasons that caused that revolution. It didn't fit in the equation that the Western world had placed for changes that occur in the society. And this is something important that we need to analyze today.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, coming back to our discussion, we are going to give an example in history, in present-day history, to see that the actual reason why people need to change or to form a revolution needs to be something spiritual. Let me give you examples. There are communities today that because of economic reasons or political reasons, they perform their revolutions. But we see that today those communities are not happy. Or those revolutions have died down. Or they have been swallowed by a higher or more powerful, let's say, hegemonic rule above them. You can see that in history today. Look at all those revolutions that happened against colonialism. Where are those countries today? Many of them are facing economic problems, social problems, difficulties, and they are not satisfied by the status quo. They have been overwhelmed by higher powers and authorities. You can see communism got destroyed. Today, capitalism is in the brink of destruction. And all those countries that are kind of under that umbrella of imperialism are also, swaying from here to there. They are not satisfied. Even those communities, even those countries that are at the peak of material development, look at their suicide rates only. You know, the Scandinavian countries, let's say, that they say that they have the most satisfaction in terms of material amenities. Look at them. The suicide rates are high. Look at other communities where people are intellectually strong, where their social systems and the structures are good, the welfare system is excellent, but yet people are not satisfied. What is the reason? So all those political changes and maneuvers that they made because of political, social, material reasons, they realized that those were not the real cause for the pain that existed in the society. And there is something else. And for that, we shall give you the example of the Islamic Revolution as a live example to show that the actual need of the communities today is spiritual in nature. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam my deen. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. السلام علیکم و رحمت الله و برکاته. Dear listeners, sisters and brothers from all around the world, I hope you're all doing well. This is your station.
Yes.
Yeah. And we are here again. And I'm really glad that I'm here. How about you, my dear sister Asma?
Yes, I'm over exhilarated.
We are coming back to our hometown, our generation, and our beautiful connection to you. As you know, 50 years ago, many children were responsible for helping on the family, like, going under heavy responsibility, like caring for younger siblings and, working at a young age and so on. And as you know...
Whenever I just hear these things, I remember Charles Dickens' David Copperfield.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I was thinking of that. And the responsibilities were kind of, seemed heavier than today. But as you know, it seems like today the children are growing faster.
You know what? I say even right now, children are going through the same thing that children were going through 50 years ago. But the appearance has changed. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm telling you that when we were younger, because time is flying and it's in such a rapid that we cannot even grasp everything that happens in each decade.
Yeah.
So I'm telling you that when I was a kid, then I had all the facilities to be a child, to act like a child, to go for different entertainment and whatever. But I also would think that maybe I have grown faster than what I should have.
So you're telling me that the cultural atmosphere is kind of putting a pressure on you to feel like that?
No. You know what I say? No. I say it depends on your personality.
Oh. If it depended on the personality, it wouldn't be that much, spread it out.
Yeah. See, because there are different causes. One of them is your personality. The other one is your family. The other one is society. The other one is...
How about our strong alliance in technology?
Of course, because we have seen it right now, I have two nieces, and then when I look at them, I just see, oh my God, they're not children.
Yeah, exactly. It feels like, okay, who are you? Are you, for example, 5 years old? I can't believe that.
I can't believe that.
I have the same feeling about them. And I think the problem is somehow the access to whatever they want, And I think they have more knowledge than they should.
But also, I would say there's another thing, They don't have siblings. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're one, and at most, they're two. And then they have to live with plenty much of people around them that are all old. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Above 30, at least. I'm not calling all the above 30 people as old. But I'm just saying that the people that they are coping up with are all from older generation.
Yeah. I myself was from these kind of situation too.
Yeah, you understand what I say.
Yeah, exactly. Because
When I was a child, I had four more of children with myself at home. So just imagine the situation. We're all children. We have different experiences.
It would be beautiful.
Every single one of us has to share their experiences with each other, and then we go for crimes together, and that's different.
Yeah, it is different. So I have the same situation that I will elaborate to after a short break. So then we go for a short break, then we'll come back again. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Youth Station, and we're talking about something really interesting. As you know, we feel like children are growing too fast. And at the last part, we're talking about our own experience for these kind of situations. That I just told you that I want to elaborate my own situation for you. You know, I was an only child for 10 years. And
after a long time.
In both, actually, family, my maternal and paternal families, I was only one child. And after 10 years, my sister came. And for 10 years, I've experienced this kind of situation that all the people around me were adults. And, you know, I felt like, okay, I'm adult too. I'm an adult too. Why not me? Why can't I do this? Why can't I tell this? Why can't I, for example, participate in this decision?
Exactly. And you know, you would say something else as well. You would say that there is no way for me to do a mistake.
Exactly.
I have to be perfect.
Yeah. And this perfectionism that I have, actually, I admit that I have it, I think comes from this point that
this
family environment. But I think there is another thing which leads to maturing so fast. And this is the healthy environment and nutrition that we have nowadays. As you know, the hormones and the kind of industrial food that we are eating, we are using, is the problem.
Yeah. Well, I can't relate much to that point.
Because you cannot relate that because, as you know, we are facing precocious puberty in our young generation, unfortunately. And the problem is the hormones that we are eating, actually. And this is the relation between them. And these hormones,
the foods and the fruits that we're taking in are no longer the organic things that we used to eat.
And because their body and they are changing physically to the adulthood, but their minds actually exist in the childhood, they will kind of feel a kind of paradoxical content in this issue.
Exactly.
And they will act as adults.
Yeah.
And this is the problem.
And you know, I was reading something. Again, it was psychological, and it said that the children that are growing faster beyond their age and beyond their years, then when they grow up, they're going to face some traumas. Likewise, like, for example, a child who has never felt like a child when he or she was a kiddo, then as they grow older, they will have this problem of being fastidious toward making decisions. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They would pick things very hardly.
And let me tell you something, even this kind of unfortunate thing will lead to some psychological disorders, you know.
Of course.
When they grow up, because they haven't experienced the childhood that much, they will have some special tendency that are strange.
Yeah,
for example, they collect some strange things.
Exactly.
You know, some strange collectioners in the world that we're actually watching and observing is, you know, they all have some roots in their childhood, these kind of problems.
Yeah, exactly.
And even crimes.
Yeah, of course.
Know? Because they feel they lack something.
See, I would say this is the rule. When you go too extreme in everything, there comes all the problems.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So balance is something we
balance
need.
Balance is very
everything.
Good.
Everything is the key.
Now, Vita, let's talk about the role of parents in these things.
I'm not a parent.
Okay, at least you can imagine
I
that.
Really skip it. Yeah, I know. Actually, the parent rule is the most important thing, I think, in this issue. You know, you cannot tell me that, okay, because the nutrition is full of hormones, you are facing this premature and you cannot do anything for that. No. The most effect is effect and impact is from the family part.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things, there is a beautiful thing that I want to read to you. This intentional balance of freedom and boundaries is exactly what children need to feel like they can still act like a kid while developing a sense of independence. And autonomy at an appropriate rate.
Yeah.
This is a quote from a professional...
psychologist.
Yeah, a psychologist. And I think it was beautiful.
Yeah.
You have to make a balance. Sometimes the boundaries that you're putting on the children will make them and lead them to doing something that is not appropriate
exactly.
for their age.
Sibita, when we were children, yeah. I remember that there were among the relatives, you know,
yeah.
there were some parents who forced their children... for example, not to touch something or not to go somewhere, not
yeah.
to do this or not to do that. When I saw them, I just felt like, as I grew older, I understood actually that those parents were the actual hindrance in the way of their children's creativity.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
For example, when
exactly.
I was a child, it was so hard to control my
curiosity.
Tendencies towards art. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Oh.
Well,
nice.
I had to play with too much of colors and painting.
So.
And then, I you know, when you have a child
I
like that.
I thought you were a bookworm.
Yes, I was
yeah.
and I am.
Thank
but
you.
Then, you know, art is something that I cannot forget about. So
yeah.
imagine you have a child like that. It is so difficult to control those children because then they would do something wrong and they would play with the mods or whatever. Dirty things, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know.
So being a mother...
troublemakers.
Yeah. Being a mother, tolerating this situation is very difficult. But now when I think of my mother, I think she was very good at doing that.
You have to be patient, you know. I think
yeah,
patient.
Patience is a very good thing.
Yeah.
You know, then you would actually let your children grow in their creativity and grow in their manners even.
Yeah.
You know, even the fact that I told you, now you said that I was the only child in both my paternal and maternal
yeah.
family. So this is very difficult. But as for us, when we gathered in my grandmother's house, there were a crowd of children.
Yeah.
There was a
you
hustle and bustle of all these children around each other. So that actually is going to help you grow better.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? So even if we are parenting children that are lonely children, we have to take them to some occasions and situations in which they could meet their fellows, you know?
Yeah.
They could have this interaction with other people of their same age because that is going to help them grow in a much healthier way.
Nice one. You know, so we're going to talk more about the solutions of this problem
mm-hmm.
after a short break. Stay tuned. Welcome back. This is
Youth Station.
And we are here talking about
growing faster than your early age.
Exactly. And we wanted to have some just solutions. I want you to just tell me in summary, what are your own solutions
well,
if you were a parent?
Well, I would say as a child, I would do everything that I think is proper to do. And then
Thank
as
you.
A parent, and then as the parent, I would let my child
yeah.
to go for whatever that...
Whatever.
See, as a child, whatever. Until
Thank
the age of seven, I would say whatever.
Yeah.
But actually not whatever, like, for example, as you see,
oh,
nowadays
yeah.
children go for breaking the TV, or I don't know, they do some harsh
not
things.
Not violent.
Yeah, exactly. That's the point. The things that are healthy and not violent, then I would let my child do that. I would try to practice being patient more and more. I would even maybe be a partner with them in all the crimes they do.
Yeah, I can imagine that. That would be a really beautiful house. I want to come.
Yes,
and
you're welcome. You can come
thank
anytime
you.
You like.
And, you know, I want to end this, actually, our beautiful conversation with my own experience. When I was a child, I was really interested in scissors and something, cutting the papers. Yeah, and, you know, my mother, like kind of exceptions, just allowed me to use the scissor from a young age, like 3 years old. Something
yeah.
even if it exists in the danger of cutting my fingers and so
yeah.
on, but she allowed it, and you know, I think it really helped me to grow this kind of creativity and
exactly
productivity in myself,
of course. And now you become a doctor.
Thank you.
You can also use that scissor.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know why I like scissors and
because you're a doctor.
I will be. And, you know, I think you have to find the balance limitation between this kind of freedom and authority that you have and you have to put on your children, you know.
Exactly.
And when you find this balance, everything will be solved.
And don't force your children into being something that they aren't. For example, you have seen it that some people force their children to go study medicine. Yes.
Mostly medicine in... I don't know, in countries like India,
in developing
Iran.
Countries, you know,
developing countries.
In developing countries, being a doctor or being the engineer or even lawyer is the final thing a parent would love their children to be.
It's the paradise. Your future will be like paradise and something, but it won't.
You found salvation. But that's not the whole truth, you know?
Exactly.
Do not force your children to be something that they aren't.
Find your talent.
Yeah. Let them be creative.
And lead them to that road.
Exactly.
They will be successful.
Don't let them be wasted.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's all. I guess that's it.
You're talking so painfully. Why?
No, I'm just talking based on experience, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's experience-based. It's like always like that you feel it from your bone that, okay, you have to do that. Because
exactly.
It's the right way.
Yeah.
So...
like always, time is flying so fast.
Yeah, exactly. At the end, we are human beings with limited sources, so we have to find the right way to go for our future.
And
our brilliant talents and go through that road. This is the solution. Thank you for listening to us. I hope that was...
a fruitful session for all of you.
Exactly.
Thank you very much.
Wassalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
A new analysis finds that the U.S. war in Somalia was waged with no clear legal basis. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Intercept wrote, "The United States has fought more than a dozen secret wars over the last two decades, according to a new report from Brennan Center for Justice at New York University's School of Law. Through a combination of ground combat, airstrikes, and operations by U.S. proxy forces, these conflicts have ranged from Africa to the West Asia region, to Central Asia, often completely unknown to the American people and with minimal congressional oversight. This proliferation of secret war is a relatively recent phenomenon, and it is undemocratic and dangerous," wrote Catherine Young, a Bright Counsel in the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program. "The conduct of undisclosed hostilities in unreported countries contravenes our constitutional design. It invites military escalation that is unforeseeable to the public, to Congress, and even to the diplomats charged with managing U.S. foreign relations," she added. "These clandestine conflicts have been enabled by 2001 Authorization for Use of Military Force enacted in the wake of September 11 attacks, as well as the Covert Action Statute, which allows secret, unattributed operations primarily conducted by the CIA. The United States has also relied on a set of obscure security cooperation authorities that the Intercept has previously investigated, including an expose earlier this year that revealed the existence of unreported U.S. counterterrorism efforts in Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen. A bright document, so-called 127E programs, known by their legal designation in those countries, and 12 others, including Afghanistan, Cameroon, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Mauritania, Niger, Nigeria, Somalia, and Tunisia, as well as a country in the Asia-Pacific region that has not yet been publicly identified. The 127E authority, which allows U.S. commandos to employ local surrogates on U.S.-directed missions targeting U.S. enemies to achieve U.S. aims, is just one of the three low-profile efforts analyzed in the Brennan Center report. Another 10 U.S. Code 333, often referred to as the Global Train and Equip Authority, allows the Pentagon to provide training and gear to foreign forces anywhere in the world. The FAR Mercure 1202 authority allows the Defense Department to offer support to foreign surrogates taking part in irregular warfare aimed at near-peer competitors like China and Russia. The report released recently offers the most complete analysis yet of the legal underpinnings, congressional confusion, and a Pentagon obfuscation surrounding these efforts, and explains how and why the Defense Department has been able to conduct under-the-table conflicts for the last 20 years. The Brennan Center's report underscores the need to shine a light on the defense activities that have been cloaked in secrecy for too long. At the bare minimum, the public and Congress need to know where and why we are sending our service members into harm's way. Representative Sarah Jacobs of California, a member of the House Armed Services Committee, told The Intercept, adding, "I hope this report strengthens the urgency of Congress taking back its war powers, eliminating existing loopholes in security operations programs, and ensuring our strategies match our values, goals, and commitment to our service members." Congress's understanding of U.S. warmaking is often no better than the public record, writes Ebright, adding, "The Departments of Defense diplomatic counterparts in the Department of State also struggle to understand and gain insight into the reach of U.S. hostilities. Where congressional oversight falters, so too does oversight within the executive branch." Ebright's analysis is particularly illuminating in the case of Somalia, where the United States developed two key proxy forces, the Dana Brigade and the Puntland Security Force. The CIA began building the Puntland Security Force in 2002 to battle the Al-Qaeda-affiliated Al-Shabaab and later the State in Somalia, or ISS. The force was transferred to U.S. military control around 2012 and went on to fight alongside U.S. Special Operations Forces for a decade. In Puntland, we built that capability, training them at the tactical level and in how to support themselves and follow a good counterinsurgency strategy against Al-Shabaab. Don Bulldog, the former chief of Special Operations Command Africa and now the Republican candidate for Senate in New Hampshire, told The Intercept in a 2019 interview. Ebright notes that the proxy fighters were largely independent of the Somali government, despite being an elite armed brigade and one of Somalia's most capable special operations units. And their relationship with U.S. forces was long kept secret, with U.S. officials disavowing the presence of military advisors in Somalia until 2014. More troubling, the analysis suggests that for a significant period of time, there was no clear legal basis for U.S. military to fight alongside and direct these forces. The Obama administration designated Al-Shabaab an associated force of Al-Qaeda and thus a legitimate target under 2001 AUMF in 2016. That administration did the same for the ISS in 2014, but ISS has never been publicly identified as an ISIS-associated force by any administration. This means that the Pentagon developed and fought alongside the Puntland Security Force from 2012 and the Donna Brigade from 2011. Under the 127E and 333 Security Cooperation Authorities. Before, the AUMF was judged to authorize hostilities against Al-Shabaab and ISIS, much less ISS. The Department of Defense is unequivocal that it does not treat 333 and 127E as authorizations for use of military force. The reality is not so clear, writes Ebright. After all, U.S. forces have used these authorities to create control and at times engage in combat alongside groups like the Puntland Security Force and Donna Brigade. Over the last 20 years, presidents have consistently claimed broad rights to act in self-defense, not only of U.S. forces, but also for partners like the Puntland Security Force and Donna Brigade, which Ebright notes potentially allows the U.S. to fight remote adversaries in the absence of any congressional authorization. Representative Jacobs said it was difficult to assure the military community in her San Diego district that we are doing everything we can to keep them safe when Congress has such little information, let alone oversight over when, where, and how we are using military force. Attempts to avoid scrutiny from Congress and Congress's own abdication of war powers is central to how we ended up in forever wars, the spike in civilian casualties, and failed strategies that waste taxpayer dollars and fuel very conflicts they are trying to solve. The report offers suggestions for improving congressional and public oversight, enforcing the balance of war powers within the government, and preventing hostilities unauthorized by Congress. Ebright writes, repealing 333, 127E, and 1202 would return the balance of power to where it stood before, the so-called War on Terror. Forcing the Pentagon to convince Congress that building foreign proxies abroad is in the United States' national security interest. This is critical given that working by, with, and through foreign surrogates and allies is key to the Pentagon's global vision. According to the Biden administration's recently released National Security Strategy and National Defense Strategy, both of those documents underscore that the DoD views security cooperation as the future of its approach, Ebright told Intercept, adding, meanwhile, on Capitol Hill and in the broader public, we don't have conversations about what this means, to the detriment of voters understanding where we are at war and how this is going to affect military involvement and entrenchment abroad.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the role of knowledge in a man's life. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome everyone, you're listening to A to Z program. I'm your host, Hossein Hinzano. And in today's lesson, we are talking about the role of knowledge in a man's life. Now, we must emphasize that all acquired knowledge, all acquired sciences, pave the way and broaden the facilities for man's true progress. They never bear a certain and indispensable impact on man's prosperity. No. As a result, learning in the form of mental reserves could not be considered as a potential perfection for man unless it becomes a means to reach qurba with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, to promote faizim, to show the means to enjoy divine blessings so as to thank Allah, or to prepare the ground for the development of oneself and others. With respect to the issue set forth, our position towards pragmatism becomes more clear. The advocates for pragmatism, which is a manifestation of humanism, are of the view that science and art are valid if they provide a better standard of living. Now, in response to this, we mark that neither worldly life nor efforts made for individual and social welfare are possessed of genuine value. We'll be back in a few minutes.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Hossein Hinzano. We are talking about the role of knowledge in the development of a man. Now, so that knowledge or science and art will become valid in the light of a man, the only thing which is essentially valid for man is the qurba of the Almighty Allah, and whatever facilitates this qurba will be valuable to the same extent and to degree that it serves a means. The perfection human being bears no label other than theism and accepts no is other than ilahism, and regards genuineness exclusive to Allah. There's a chapter in the Quran that states, Surah number 22, verse number 62. It states that is because Allah is the truth, and that what they call upon besides Him, that is the falsehood. As a consequence, neither acquirement of knowledge and art, nor individual and social work possesses absolute validity. All of them will gain validity only in cases whereby they are done to serve Allah and are carried out in the light of establishing relationship with Him only. Thank you so much for following up on this episode. We are happy we are following up on these programs. Until next episode, inshallah, we'll meet again. Fi amanillah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The United Kingdom is facing skyrocketing inflation, which has been unprecedented for decades, prompting thousands of British people in various industries to strike over payments. We take a look at the World Press and Media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Bloomberg News Agency has more for us. Britain is facing more industrial action as postal workers, university lecturers and staffers have renewed their strike in protest at low payment and employment conditions. The strikes took place on Wednesday, 30th of November, featuring Royal Mail workers, university lecturers and teachers in 77 sixth form colleges. The mass protest action saw lines forming outside of Royal Mail centres, universities and further education colleges. The University and College Union, UCU, General Secretary Joe Grady said, "University staff are prepared to do whatever it takes to win decent pay, secure employment and fair pensions, and vice-chancellors need to understand that they cannot simply ride this out. Students and staff are united like never before." Dr. Mary Boosted, General Secretary of the National Education Union, NEU, said, "The overwhelming majority of teachers in sixth form colleges will receive a 5% pay rise this year, which simply doesn't deal with the effect of inflation." The strikes come as the country is grappling with a soaring cost of living crisis. Various labour unions across the United Kingdom are preparing for similar protest action ahead of Christmas. The British government has warned of a challenging winter if services stopped working. Experts say the soaring cost of living crisis has engulfed the whole of Europe, with workers going on strike every now and then across the European continent, disrupting both local and international schedules, particularly during holidays. They blame the soaring living costs in Europe on the Russia-Ukraine conflict as well as the COVID-19 pandemic. Meanwhile, the British newspaper The Daily Mail has more for us. The British government has rejected workers' requests for better pay after ambulance workers joined nurses in voting to go on strike. After the Unison Union confirmed the ambulance service faced its biggest strike in 30 years, Britain's Health Secretary Steve Barclay said on Wednesday, 30th of November, "Our economic circumstances mean union demand are not affordable." Unison announced late on Tuesday, 29th of November, that paramedics, ambulance technicians and emergency call handlers would go on strike for 24 hours before Christmas. The call for industrial action came after members of the union held a strike ballot. Unison General Secretary Christina McKenna said it was a tough call for the ambulance workers to join the strike. She said, "But thousands of ambulance staff and their NHS colleagues know delays won't lessen nor waiting times reduce until the government acts on wages." The latest strike will affect London and four other regions of England as the ambulance service joins nurses across most of Britain in striking over government pay offers, which fall well short of double-digit inflation and soaring cost-of-living crisis. The nurses' strike will be sandwiched between the first of a series of two-day walkouts by National Railway workers, while Postal Service employees will stage fresh stoppages in the run-up to Christmas. Numerous other public and private sector staff, from lawyers to airport ground personnel, are also holding strikes this year as Britain faces its highest inflation and worst cost-of-living crisis in a generation. Meanwhile, British media reports say health and defence officials are drawing up a contingency strategy to invoke the military aid to the civil authorities protocol, the MACA protocol, to keep key services running as ambulance drivers and paramedics vote on whether to join strike action. British media reported that the British government had drawn up a plan to use British soldiers to fill in for striking Border Force staff. About 600 servicemen and women will provide cover for members of the Border Force staff whose PCS union called on them to take industrial action following balloting. The British soldiers are to receive 5 days of training, which include checking passports and identifying trafficked children. The British government has also drawn up plans to use more of its soldiers to cover for firefighters who will be balloted in the coming days over strike action. British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. Nurses across Britain will go on strike for the first time over 2 days in the fortnight before Christmas after ministers rejected their pleas for formal talks over NHS pay. The Royal College of Nursing said its members would stage national strikes, the first in its 106-year history, on 15th and 20th of December. Senior sources said the industrial action was expected to last for 12 hours on both days, most likely between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. local time. The unprecedented national industrial action will seriously disrupt care and is likely to be the first in a series of strikes over the winter and into the spring by other National Health Service staff, including junior doctors and ambulance workers. The Royal College of Nursing said it had confirmed the dates after the British government turned down its offer of formal detailed negotiations as an alternative to industrial action. The Royal College of Nursing's General Secretary, Pat Cullen, said, "Ministers have had more than 2 weeks since we confirmed that our members felt such injustice that they would strike for the first time. My offer of formal negotiations was declined by the government, and instead ministers have chosen strike action."
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Current world order will be replaced by a new order where US is isolated, Asia powerful, resistance front expanded. This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with students on Wednesday, November 2nd, 2022. This meeting was held on the occasion of National Students' Day and National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance, which are commemorated on the 13th of Aban, 4th of November. The first person in the world to say neither East nor West was Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh. Neither East nor West. In those days, the world's power was split between the US and the Soviet Union. Imam Khomeini said neither this nor that. All the countries in the world had to either be connected to the US or the Soviet Union. They felt they had no other choice. But he said, neither this nor that. This spirit, this logic, this solid and firm word has spread. Today, there are many people in the region who consider themselves to be affiliated with the resistance front. They are ready to resist. They believe in the resistance. They resist, and in many cases, they get results like the outcome that was achieved by the Lebanese because of Hezbollah's efforts in the case of determining the maritime gas field borders.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I talked about three basic lines: the isolation of the United States, the transfer of power to Asia, the expansion of the resistance front, and the logic of the resistance. Indeed, other matters can also be added. They are in my mind, but these things were the more essential issues. So what is Iran's role in this new order? Where will Iran be placed? What position will our dear country hold? This is the thing that you need to think about. This is what you need to prepare yourselves for. This is the things that the Iranians' youth can work on. We can have an outstanding position in this new order. We really can. Why? Because our country has outstanding features that many other countries lack. First of all, we have human resources. We have really good human resources. The intelligence and talent of young Iranians is higher than the average intelligence and talent of the world. This exists.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
More than 1 year after the Taliban returned to power, a Gallup survey has found that almost all Afghans, or 98%, rate their lives poorly enough to be considered suffering. The survey shows that the situation is getting worse for Afghans, and they have fully lost hope that their future will be any better.
Absolutely, people are suffering, especially from joblessness, poverty, insecurity, and little access to their basic rights. Their life conditions were grim even before the Taliban takeover, but recently people's hardships have become even worse. Still, we are not sure what the future holds for us.
Currently, Afghan girls and women are dealing with many difficulties, especially their struggle to get education or a job to make ends meet. Poverty has not only affected men, but also the well-being of Afghan women and children. Being relatively barred from public places makes us further desperate.
According to the survey, 9 in 10 Afghans say they find it very difficult to make ends meet. 92% of the respondents say they think it is a bad time to find a job, while 86% say they have been unable to buy themselves food.
Making ends meet has become very difficult. We need to skip some meals to survive. The arrival of the cold season is adding to the people's suffering. With no job and relief assistance, you can imagine how disastrous people's lives can become.
I'm the sole breadwinner of my 8-member family. Sometimes I can put food on the table, but sometimes we go to bed hungry. The situation is so difficult that sometimes we can't even buy ourselves some oil. Having heating or other necessities is becoming almost impossible.
The Gallup survey also reveals that the unpopularity of the American leadership has risen to a record 84% among Afghans. Meanwhile, the poll shows more and more Afghans are looking favorably towards Iran, as the neighboring country's popularity is on the rise. Afghanistan is rated as the most suffering and unhappiest country in the world. Many here believe the current situation is a direct result of the U.S. occupation and war in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Russian prisoners of war being executed by Ukrainian soldiers. Multiple videos have been released on Ukrainian Telegram channels. The most recent shows 11 Russian soldiers shot in the head after being detained. While both sides accuse each other of war crimes, Kiev is openly flaunting the crimes committed at the hands of its troops. At a press conference in Lugansk, a Russian soldier, Dmitry, recounts what happened when he was captured on the front line.
They ordered me to lie down, hands behind my back. One of them came up to me and hit my back with the handle of his machine gun. They put a bag on my head and waited for their commanders. In some time, the commander came, took the bag off my head, took me by the throat and started to cut my left hand with a knife. It's still functioning badly. He hit me in the teeth. And afterwards, when they took my machine gun from the vehicle, he asked if it was charged. I answered that it wasn't. He took the cartridge from it, clicked it, pointed at my leg and clicked. Nothing happened, because it was really not charged. He said I was lucky.
On the screen, gruesome images. Russian authorities say they have evidence of torture and a lack of provision of basic medical care, leading to unnecessary death.
Now, many of these atrocities are being ignored by media outlets in NATO countries, but Russian journalists, of course, are here transmitting to a Russian audience, which means large parts of the Russian population are becoming increasingly angry at Ukraine and its NATO backers for atrocities committed against Russian soldiers.
The videos that show Russian prisoners of war being essentially murdered after they've surrendered have been posted by Ukrainian soldiers. These are videos taken by Ukrainian soldiers and then posted on the internet. Essentially as a point of pride, in the belief that they are somehow or another frightening or horrifying the Russians, who knows. But I also think there's another sinister dimension to this. I think there's an interest in Ukraine, particularly in Kiev or Kyiv, to ensure that there can be no negotiated settlement between Ukraine and Russia, not so much because of people in Kiev that might be willing to talk, but I think there's growing fear that Washington will ultimately abandon them.
As Russia continues to destroy energy infrastructure and kill Ukrainian soldiers on the front lines in Donbass, and as Ukraine continues to shell civilians in Donetsk and release videos of its war crimes, anger is reaching new heights on both sides, making peace an even more distant prospect. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
The repercussions of the war in Yemen and the difficult economic conditions continue to take a heavy toll on Yemeni patients. Yemen's Ministry of Public Health and Population held a press conference to shed light on